cancer diagnosis at the age of 32, my mom and I talked a lot about the shock of that diagnosis, given several doctors told us you're too young to have endometrial cancer. After much discussion, we began to feel driven to inform and help educate other young women about what symptoms they should be concerned.
Having both been teachers, it seemed natural for us to look for a way to share Alex's cancer journey in order to help other young women avoid such a shocking diagnosis or possibly navigate a similar path. A podcast seemed the best way to get the word out, and that's how Down There Aware was born.
4 years later, our mother-daughter duo has gone from educating and informing to advocacy and action, with a fresh and sometimes very interesting and somewhat humorous multi-generational perspective.
We look forward to sharing with you season 4 as we advocate, take action, and make it a priority to always be
Down There Aware.
Welcome back to another episode of Down There Aware. We're glad you're here. It's the month of May.
Oh, the merry month of May.
Mm-hmm. Makes me think of Camelot. So we are back in the group. Nobody got sick this week.
Hallelujah.
Nothing bad happened. Mom and Dad celebrated their birthdays.
Yes.
That was fun. Got to hang out. Do some fun birthday activities.
Yep. Ate and baked and fun times.
All of our favorite things.
Favorite things.
So, yeah. Well, this week we got to thinking about some topics that are ones that we have personal experience with and that we can talk about. And so we thought about second opinions. And when do you seek a second opinion? When should you seek a second opinion? Should you feel badly about seeking a second opinion?
What happens if you don't get a second opinion? Mm-hmm.
So all those things. So we hope in the next little bit, we can kind of talk through some of that, give some personal examples of things that we have dealt with, people we know have dealt with, to just open your mind a little bit about if you're going through a medical issue right now, what seeking a second opinion could mean for you.
Yeah, I think there's a stigma surrounding looking for a second opinion. It seems that people look at it as a negative. And I've been told by physicians that they don't take it personally. It's not a negative. They applaud your due diligence in checking things out. So I trust that, you know, straight from the horse's mouth kind of thing. That it is a smart thing to get a second opinion. And we talked a little bit about kind of the levels of reasoning. First of all, I think if you just want to gather more information.
Yeah, like if it's something that there's no familial history, you've never heard of this condition, you know, have zero experience with it, and you really just want to learn more. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great, you know, opportunity, because every doctor is trained a little bit differently and they have different expertises. And, you know, maybe you can find someone who that's their focus and it's not just something they do.
Well, and you want different perspectives. Mm-hmm. You know, doctors are people and they have opinions and they make judgment calls, and one might make one and somebody else make a totally different one. So gathering different perspectives and different information, I think, is healthy. I know we experienced that, and we've talked, really just touched on it one time about how Will, your brother, my son, was born with what's called a pectus excavatum, where the cartilage that connects the sternum to the rib cage is deformed. And it can either pull the sternum inward, causing a big dent in the chest, or it can push the sternum out, causing a what they call a turkey breast, kind of a bowed chest look. And Will's was sunken in. And when he was born, We were told that they would just keep an eye on it, that it wasn't life-threatening right now, and he would be followed as an infant and toddler. So when he was four, he was followed all those years. And when he was four, his doctor, pediatrician said, yeah, I think it's time. And he's going to need to have surgery. And this surgery is a very extensive surgery where they, it's kind of like open heart in that they saw the rib cage and get in, well, I guess they saw the sternum to get in. And they take out the cartilage that's deformed and they re-suture the cartilage lining from the rib cage to the sternum, put a bar in the chest. He lived with a bar for a year, had limited activity requirements, and then they took the bar out a year later. So that's a pretty big deal for a four-year-old. And we thought it was good to hear what was entailed in that surgery, but we wanted to know more. So we took him to Shands, UF Health now, and talked to the head of pediatric surgery. And then we took him to Children's Hospital in Birmingham and talked to a pediatric surgeon there. They both agreed exactly what had to be done. And so we picked Shands for a lot of reasons. Mainly it was closer, but my husband's a Gator, so he loved it being there. And Will was born in Alachua General, right in Gainesville. So that second opinion was mainly information gathering. And that's, you know, one of the reasons you might want another opinion.
Yeah. And it confirmed what everybody mm-hmm. was saying. And we're all on the same page. Yes, this is best practice. This is, you know, it's not a common condition, but this is the common treatment for it. And yeah. So that confirmed that. And I had an experience where we sought a second opinion because we were not confident in what the physician at the time was saying I needed to do. And that was when I was in high school and I was diagnosed with, at the time, they called pseudotumor cerebri. It's now been redefined as idiopathic intracranial hypertension. But at that time, the doctor, it was a neurologist. He had seen my spinal taps. I had had three at that point, I think. They were all astronomically high, higher than they should be. And he said, you know, I really want to take a moderate approach. I want to put her on a diet. She's overweight. And that's a contributing factor. That's like that. He really hung his hat on.
Like only, that was the reason she had
only
it.
Fat people get this. And I was 16. And yes, I was, you know, overweight. But I was a swimmer. I was healthy. I was active. And so he hung his hat up on that, branch. And so he wanted to put me on a diet and just put me on medication. And meanwhile, I had lost all of my periphery. I was seeing double. I was having blurred vision. I was having long spells of essentially blacking out. I was not having memories of certain activities and things that were going on. I was in the hospital at this time. And so Mom, rightfully so, swooped in and said, hey, I'm not comfortable with a conservative, modest approach. This is, you know, she has issues now. She could lose her sight. Like, this is a big deal. And requested very adamantly that we had a neurosurgery consult, just because in her research, surgery was another option. And so to get this surgeon's opinion, who would say, yeah, I think she's ready for this, or no, she's not. And he was very quick to say, absolutely, she does not need to wait. We need to do surgery tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that
was a Sunday.
Yeah, it was.
It was a Saturday that he said tomorrow. She had the surgery on Sunday. Right. So
calling in, you know, a team to come in, because they typically don't schedule surgeries on Sundays. He was not even going to wait another 24 hours. He was like, you've been in the hospital this long. Your vision is this bad. Your numbers are this high. And so he was, you know, really adamant about it. And I'm grateful that, you know, Mom took the initiative to get a second opinion. And not that she was questioning that physician's knowledge or experience, but she knew me and what I was saying to her and what she had experienced over the last several weeks. And it was just a no-brainer for her that, like, this is not the right answer. It just didn't sit well.
Well, I was not willing to risk you losing any more vision. You had lost your peripheral vision. And to me, and I said to him when he argued with me, and he did argue with me about it, I said to him, what are you going to do? Wait until she's blind before you realize this approach isn't working. She's already lost her peripheral vision. And you've told me you don't know if it's going to come back. So why in the world would we risk that? And I think, you know, I'm the mom. He's the doctor. I have a lot more of a vested interest, no matter what. I mean, I get that he's a doctor and he took an oath, but as far as the approach, I'm the mom and I wasn't willing to risk it where he was willing to risk it.
Right.
You hear all the time people say to doctors, what would you do if it was your mother? What would you do if it was your child? Mm-hmm. What would you? And that's why they do that, because it's a risk factor, because it's not black and white. It's not, you know, there's not a cutoff, but you have to make certain judgment calls. And I wasn't willing to take that risk.
Yeah. And I also think knowing, like, we know ourselves best, and your doctor, while yes, they have the medical knowledge and any experience they may have with other patients, those patients are not you. And that doctor has limited experience with you, with your symptoms and with your, you know, your condition. And so, you have to trust your gut feeling. I'm reading a book right now called The Gift of Fear, and it's all about, our natural built-in defense mechanisms of perception and suspicion and all of these things that, you know, you just kind of know someone's not a good person, or you know to be wary of a certain situation. And the book really leans into personal safety and things like that. But that intuition of, I know myself better, maybe I should get a second opinion, you really have to listen to that. Mm-hmm. It's not something to be ignored just because you're intimidated by, well, they have a degree or they've treated so many people with this, because it could mean the difference between you losing your sight, you losing your life, you know, like, there are all kinds of different consequences.
Well, and he is the neurologist we were assigned at the hospital when you went to the ER. He wasn't our doctor. We didn't have a relationship with him. He didn't know you. And I think that makes a huge difference. Because you have that condition, we now have a great relationship with a local neurologist who, a neurosurgeon and neurologist who know you, have treated you. And that makes a big deal, a big difference with trust.
Yeah, it really does. Because, you know, several years later, I had a recurrence and I had already established a relationship here in Tallahassee. And all I had to do was call and say, something's not right. I know my symptoms. And it doesn't help that I also have a very rare version of this rare condition that I don't, my symptoms don't present like most people. I'm not a textbook case, go figure, that I don't fall in line with, you know, you should feel like this and this and this. And I remember even after I got sent home from the ER, my symptoms came back pretty strong and persistent, and mom called the hospital, and I don't know if it was the doctor or the nurse or something, but it was relayed back that said, there's no way that she could be feeling these symptoms that quickly. There's no way that her CSF pressure is up that high that quickly. And sure enough, it was.
Yeah,
and
because so she went in.
I went in and they did another spinal tap, and sure enough, it was. And so it's one of those things where I knew I'm a 15-year-old child. I'm not making stuff up. It's summer. I'm not missing school.
Well, plus I knew her and I knew she wasn't making stuff up.
Right.
I mean, you know, I knew the difference in exaggeration or.
Right. And, you know, because leading up to the point where I went to the hospital for over a week, I was acting very differently than I normally would. I was sleeping all the time. I couldn't get comfortable because my back hurt, and that was my main symptom. And that's why they were confused, because that's not a main symptom of this condition. And I would switch beds. I would sleep in the guest bed. One time I slept on the bathroom floor because that felt the best. And it's just one of those things where it's like, if your teenager is acting like this,
yeah, you're not making that up.
Like, this is not something that I'm just doing to get attention or whatever. And all of the tests and the numbers supported what I was feeling. Mm-hmm. But it just goes to show you that you do know yourself best, and you have to trust that going into that situation, like mom says, you want their file folder to be just as full as yours is, and to understand that you're a unique person in this situation, and that yes, your book knowledge is great, but you need to also add on top of who I am.
Yeah. That's why we've really preached on the podcast about doctors looking at each patient as a unique individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Alex fell into that with her cancer diagnosis of, no, you're too young. You know, that her symptoms did not present themselves as most people with IIH. But she has it. And so that's why you trust and you communicate, mm-hmm. so that you can get the service you need from the medical community.
Yep, for sure.
And then the third one we talked about.
You're staring at me like I'm supposed to remember, and I don't remember.
It's if you have been treated and the treatments are not working, mm-hmm. and you're getting worse, or at the very least not getting better, then you say, okay, something's not right. If this is where this doctor has gone, it's not working. I need to go to another doctor.
Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, do we have an example of this kind of way to seek a second opinion? And mine is kind of a story in terms of, I didn't seek a second opinion because I did trust what was going on, but maybe I should have. So we all know, if you've been listening for a little while, I had back surgery in August, and that is from an injury that occurred when I was in college in 2007, we think. But it really first presented itself in 2013. And I was diagnosed with two herniated discs. And the solution to that was these pain injections and some physical therapy. Graduated from physical therapy pretty quickly. And the injections, they said, as long as you're not getting them any sooner than 6 months to a year apart, then you're good. And you just can do those forever and ever. Amen. Until you really can't, you know, stand to have them that far apart anymore. And then the conversation is going to turn to a spinal fusion, and you don't want a spinal fusion. Like, that's the message that was sent to me.
That was the whole plan.
That was the entire plan. And it was communicated in such a way of, once you have back surgery, you're going to have back surgery every year after that, and you're going to live a horrible life, and your quality of life is going to go down. And so I trusted that opinion and
didn't seek anything else,
in part because those pain injections worked.
Yeah.
It was miraculous, dare I say. And I lived my life and it was fine. But now, having gone through this process where I ended up at a different practice, and after all of their testing, they were like, we have this other option, it is a surgery, but it's not a fusion. It's not something that's going to impact you negatively in, you know, your mobility or anything like that. And I said, yes, let's go for it. And when he got in there, I had pushed off surgery so long that the disc material that had come out and herniated out of the disc had calcified. Now,
so he couldn't get it all.
He got what he could, and he, you know, kind of left that surgery like, maybe you'll be fixed, maybe you won't. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine.
And it worked.
It worked. All my strength is back. Everything's pretty much back to normal. And so I just kept thinking, if 10 years ago, had I thought, maybe I need a second opinion, maybe I should talk to somebody else, would they have given me this other option? And I could have had surgery 10 years ago when I was much more active. And I mean, at that point I was training for a 5K and I had just gotten into running and all this stuff. And you know, my life changed after that with my back injury, and it just made, you know, it's a game of what ifs. You mm-hmm. can't play that. You can't say, oh, I wish I had done this, but it does help us inform others of, it's probably always a good idea to seek a second opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it really cannot hurt.
No.
Mm-mm. Even if
the worst it is an extra copay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
Even if the two opinions, one and two, are diametrically opposed, you can get a third.
Yeah.
You know, so there's really no reason not to.
Yeah. The limit does not exist.
No.
Like, there is no stopping who you talk to. And it could be in the same practice. I mean, I was seeing a specific neurosurgeon in a practice here that has, it's a very large practice. There are probably 6 or 7 neurosurgeons in that practice. Mm-hmm. I could have seen any of them, any of anybody else to say like, hey, can we talk about this? I could have gone, you know, my folks lived in Orlando at the time. I could have gone down there and, you know, talked to somebody else. There are so many different places that you can find that second opinion, that it really just, it doesn't hurt. And even with my cancer diagnosis, I didn't, now, and we've talked about this before, I did feel a sense of urgency, like, get the cancer out of me. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of fed into getting a second opinion. But what I've learned is a lot of cancers grow pretty slowly. So you do have time to, you know, wait a couple of weeks and find that second
sometimes
opinion.
Sometimes you do.
Sometimes yeah. you do. And sometimes you don't. But it's, I don't know of a situation where it would be a bad idea to seek a second opinion.
I agree. Especially something as serious as your back surgery and your cancer. I mean, those are
things that are going to affect your life.
Exactly.
Forever.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's just filling your knowledge as much as you can. And you can do research on your own and find lots of different things. And I think that's also kind of a form of a second opinion. If you're finding, you know, if you find a specific case that mirrors what you're going through and it's from a different doctor, maybe you can't go see that doctor, but you can bring that to your physician and say, hey, what about this treatment? What about this medication? What about this, you know, whatever it is? Can we talk about it? What do you think about this? So there's always another option.
Yeah, I think, so it's good to not assume you're going to hurt the doctor's feelings. I mean, they're not that sensitive about you going to get a second opinion.
And even if they are, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, not about what somebody else thinks.
No, exactly. And that doctor's not your best friend. That doctor's probably not related to you. I mean, maybe in a small town, but, you know, so like, sorry, bud, but I have to take responsibility for me. Mm-hmm. And if it's a minor you're dealing with and you're that guardian or parent, you have to take responsibility for that child. Yeah, I'm going to be as protective as I can. And I have no qualms hurting people's feelings.
Yeah. And I do think not allowing yourself to get in such a hurry that you don't do things the way you would do if you just sat down and took a beat.
Sometimes I feel like I rush into things and rush into decisions because I just feel anxious about, I have this new diagnosis, I have this situation that's happening, and I don't sit and wait for a minute and kind of think about all of my options and just go with the, okay, that one's okay. That'll work. I can deal with that. Just because I want to make a decision.
Well, and it disrupts your life and you want to get on with living, take care of it. And you're a doer.
Yeah.
So take care of it so I can keep living my life. But it's good to just sit back, take a beat, give it some thought and energy and research and discussion, whatever it needs, before you make decisions. So don't think your doctor's going to be upset. Don't rush into it. Take your time and ask experts where to get the second opinion. If the second opinion doesn't satisfy you, get another opinion. Mm-hmm. There's no cutoff on how many opinions you can get. It's a very worthwhile endeavor to be sure of whatever it is decision you need to make, to be sure about it.
Yeah. And I think if the doctor is a good doctor, they will appreciate having more information. They'll appreciate having another opinion and another perspective, because they're scientists and that's what they do, right? They have a hypothesis and they do an experiment and then they figure out what's wrong. And so, I think if having more perspectives and having more information, if they really are a physician who cares about their patients' well-being and not just getting that surgery count or, you know, moving on to the next patient, if they really care about your outcome, then they'll appreciate and welcome a second, third, fourth opinion.
And I think they appreciate that the patient is involved enough and cares enough about their own health to be sure they've researched it and they have looked into what they need to go into it with their eyes open. Mm-hmm. I think they appreciate that in a patient.
Yeah, I do too.
And if they don't, they should.
We could teach doctors a lot of things.
Oh, I think we could anyway.
Yeah. Again, if we ruled the world. So, thanks for listening. Sadie has come to tell us that
it is
time for us to wrap it up. But thanks for listening, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Down There Aware. Be sure to like and subscribe on our new YouTube channel, as well as on your favorite podcast platform. You can find us at Down There Aware on all social media sites, Twitter, Pinterest, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram. If you have it, we're there at Down There Aware. You can learn more on our website, www.downthereaware.com, and always get in touch with us, downthereaware@gmail.com. See you next week.